What I've attempted to do on this tape is explain why I think it is that people cling to beliefs that by any rational standard, and in any other context, they would not only not believe, but would enthusiastically reject. I suggested that ignorance of the Bible's uglier parts can play a role. I've also suggested that confusion can play a role. Unlike ignorance, which is simply an absence of data for processing, confusion is an unnatural processing of the data, or an unnatural way of thinking. And because it is unnatural, confusion is something that people must be conditioned to embrace. And where does this conditioning come from? It comes from the individual's cultural environment. And that environment can be his family, it can be his social community, it can be his religious community, it can be his entire country. In the case of Christianity, it often encompasses all of these. I don't think anyone's going to argue with this notion that culture plays a powerful role in shaping a person's religious beliefs. Having said that, though, I do think there's more than just culture at work in the minds of believers. And that's because religion addresses issues that transcend culture, issues that are fundamental to the human experience itself. What am I talking about? I'm talking about curiosity. We human beings are naturally curious. We ask questions. We want answers. Moreover, and this is the important part, given the nature of human experience itself, there are some questions that we all ask, regardless of our culture. I believe that the almost universal appeal of religion throughout all of recorded history is due to the fact that religion claims to have the answers to these questions. The questions I'm referring to are basically these three. What is the origin of reality? Is there life after death? And how should we act? These three questions are asked by all human beings because all human beings experience the following. We begin to live, we live, and then we stop living. These three experiences naturally lead us to wonder where this experience of reality came from, what's going to happen to it when we die, and what should we be doing with it while it's here? You see, these questions are not a product of culture. They're a product of the human experience itself. So on the one hand, we have curious human beings who long for answers to these fundamental questions, while on the other hand, we have these religions that claim to be in possession of the answers. It doesn't take a rocket scientist to see why human beings have been attracted to religion. To those who embrace these religious answers, the payoff is that out of these religious answers emerges a sense of meaning in life, purpose in life, and morality. Herein lies the perceived value of religion. To the countless millions who embrace it, religion is thought to be the very wellspring of human significance. The perception seems to be that without a belief in God and religion, human existence would quickly plunge into a state of existential anarchy, and the universe as we know it would collapse into a meaningless void. That's some pretty powerful stuff. Hand in hand with this attitude is this popular notion that there are no meaningful alternatives to religion. In other words, when it comes to dealing with these fundamental issues of meaning in life, purpose in life, and morality, religion is viewed as the only game in town. Actually, it's even worse than that. There's a popular prejudice in our country that any philosophy that doesn't have a God in it is just plain evil. Atheism has been powerfully linked in the popular mind to communism and to tyrants such as Stalin, Hitler, and Mao. Now, to freedom-loving U.S. capitalists, among whom I count myself, these are some terrifying images. And these images generate a very powerful force. Not a force that draws one to his religion, but rather a force that repels him from all non-religious alternatives. Again, this is powerful stuff, and it's intellectually powerful. We're not just talking emotion anymore. This is largely an intellectual position. Now, is it an intellectually valid position? Well, that's another story. But to someone who presumes it to be valid, life without religion is simply not an option. The alternatives, in his mind at least, are unthinkable. so he clings to his religion, seemingly, at all costs. I'd like to return to two of the fundamental questions I mentioned earlier. Specifically, what is the origin of reality, and is there life after death? The Bible's answers to these questions are basically as follows. The origin of reality is to be found in something called God. Now, just exactly what God is, well, that depends. Concepts of what God is vary from person to person, even among those who claim to share the same religious affiliation. Be that as it may, God is the answer to this first question. By the way, I think it's easy to see why people might want to believe in a God. Remember, human beings have a natural desire to understand how reality works. To think that there might exist one guy in the whole universe who has all the answers to all the questions we would ever want to ask, well, a guy like that could come in very handy. But notice that in order for this one guy with all the answers to do us any good at all, he'll have to possess the ability to communicate with us somehow. So in some sense, he would have to be a personal being. Not surprisingly, a personal God is exactly what we find in the Bible. Let's turn to this other question. Is there life after death? The Bible's answer to this question is clearly yes. Although, as was the case with God, there's a great deal of disagreement as to what life after death will actually be like. Now, another belief that just kind of naturally emerges from a belief in God and the afterlife is a belief in the existence of two different worlds, a physical world and a spiritual world. A belief in God pretty much mandates this because we can't really see God, yet we're told that He is real. So the thinking here is that there's really two worlds or dimensions, and that we human beings sort of coexist in both of these worlds at the same time. Our bodies are part of the physical world, while our minds, or spirits, are part of this spiritual world. The significance of a belief in these two worlds for our discussion here is this. There's a popular notion that knowledge and understanding in these two worlds are acquired in different ways. In the physical world, the scientific method is the foundation of our understanding. In the spiritual world, faith is that foundation. Now, we could spend a long, long time talking about the nature of faith. What it is, does it work, what can it teach us, and so on. But I'm not going to do that. What I'm going to do instead is I'm going to share with you what I believe to be the essence of the scientific method. I'm taking this approach because I think that once we understand the nature of the scientific approach to gaining understanding, I think the nature of any other approach will become obvious. To help us better understand the fundamental nature of the scientific approach to understanding, I'd like to share with you a quote from Stephen Hawking's book, A Brief History of Time. On page 10, Hawking writes, quote, "Any physical theory is always provisional, in the sense that it is only a hypothesis. You can never prove it. No matter how many times the results of experiments agree with some theory, you can never be sure that the next time the result will not contradict the theory. On the other hand, you can disprove a theory by finding even a single observation that disagrees with the predictions of the theory. Each time new experiments are observed to agree with the predictions, the theory survives. But if ever a new observation is found to disagree, we have to abandon or modify the theory." End of quote. Now, there are three things about this approach to understanding that I want you to take note of. The first is that it is strict. It's one strike and you're out. It's very unforgiving. And the reason it's unforgiving is due to the nature of what it is that we're trying to accomplish. We are trying to gain an accurate understanding of how reality works. Now, perhaps we have some idea about the way we feel reality works, or how we would like for reality to work, or how our great ancestors insisted that reality works. Now, these ideas may make for amusing speculation, but when it comes to scientific understanding, I mean stuff you can take to the bank, if these feelings or wishes or traditions can't stand up to reality itself, then all these ideas are bad ideas. They're wrong ideas. They're untrue ideas. It's as simple as that. You see, in science, reality rules. The second thing I want you to notice here is that good scientific theories do not pretend to offer us certainty. What good scientific theories do offer is confidence. Now, does this inability of science to provide us with certainty diminish its usefulness? Not really. I mean, think about it. We are so confident in what science has taught us that we routinely take trips on airplanes. We allow doctors to literally cut our bodies wide open in order to make us feel better and live longer. We pack up our cars and head for the hills when we see a hurricane coming at us on a radar screen. Our tremendous confidence in science is evidenced by our willingness to base our actions on its findings. And this brings me to the third and what I believe to be the most important aspect of Hawking's quote. The quote underscores the role that honesty plays in a scientific pursuit of the truth. In fact, I believe the real essence of science is honesty. Can you see that? All the fancy equipment and all the strict methodology that scientists employ are there to accomplish two things. First, to help the scientist make more accurate observations, and second, to keep him honest. Science is a systematic approach to understanding reality, and the fundamental mechanism of this approach is honesty. Now I want to make a sort of bold point here. It seems fashionable today for people to compartmentalize their thinking. And by compartmentalize, I mean they agree that science is a great tool when it comes to dealing with things in the physical world. But in those areas where science cannot provide us with answers, we must look to religion for the answers. I could not disagree more with this way of thinking, and let me explain why. I believe the fundamental mechanism of the scientific method is honesty. If you can agree with me on this point, then I would ask you this. In our quest to develop a true understanding of reality, under what circumstances would honesty not be appropriate? I can't think of any. When theologians proclaim that science is a wonderful thing in the physical realm, but that we must have faith and look to religion for wisdom in the spiritual realm, what they're saying to me in effect is this. It's okay to be honest when it comes to physical things, but when it comes to other matters, religious matters, well, we don't really need to be honest anymore. We can just kind of make this stuff up as we go along. If the fundamental mechanism of science is in fact honesty, then how could we view this matter any other way? Now you might be scratching your head at this point and asking yourself, how do we apply the scientific method to religious matters? That's a good question. But let me rephrase that question, and maybe the answer will pop out all by itself. How do we apply honesty to religious matters? To answer that question, we need to look at the religious claims, the religious theories. Let's return once more to this question, is there life after death? Now, many religions tell us that there is life after death. That is their claim. That is their theory. Okay, how do we perform an experiment to confirm this claim? Well, guess what? There is no experiment. Short of killing yourself, and I'm guessing you probably aren't ready to do that. And even if you did kill yourself, it wouldn't do the rest of us much good. Okay, so we can't test this claim through experiment. Oh no. What do we do now? It's at this point in our inquiry where honesty is most important. And I'm going to get closer to the microphone here for dramatic emphasis because this next part really strikes at the heart of the matter. What would be the scientific answer to the question, is there life after death? Or rather, what would be the honest answer to the question, is there life after death? My friends, the honest answer is, we don't know. We don't know. How about this question of the origin of reality? We don't know. Does a supernatural being exist that created the universe? We don't know. Again, I would ask you, what kind of experiment would you perform to test this? What kind of experience would you need to have before you could state with confidence that life after death is a reality? What kind of experience would you need to have before you could state with confidence that God created the universe? I mean, were you there when He did it? Look, there are some things we just don't know. That makes us feel uneasy. We desire understanding. We want answers. We even demand answers. We look into the mystery of life after death and the mystery of the origin of our existence, and even though we're in no position to answer these questions, damn it, we want answers anyway. So what do we do with this mystery? Are we honest with ourselves and do we leave it the mystery that it is? No. What we do instead is we play Mr. Potato Head with the thing. We take this mystery and we put a nose on it, and we put big lips and eyes on it, and maybe we give it a little hat. And after having made this mystery appear to be something we think we can understand, which usually means making it look like us, we then give the thing a name. And of course, we call this thing by lots of different names. We call it Jesus or Jehovah or Zeus, just fill in the blank. What we've done, in effect, is we have performed a cosmic makeover on the mystery of our existence. And in so doing, we have created a counterfeit view of reality. We have created false understanding. We have created religion. Something else I'd like for you to take note of here is the manner in which many religious people characterize their belief. For example, when Christians tell others about Jesus, what do they call it? They call it witnessing. They are a witness of Jesus Christ, like they've actually seen the guy. Or they claim to have a close personal relationship with God, like they've actually met God, shook God's hand, carried on two-way conversations with God, played golf with God. You know, they're buddies. Notice too the language that many of them, not all of them, but many of them employ when they tell you about their God. They'll say things like, I know that God lives, and I know that Jesus Christ rose from the dead, and I know these things with every fiber of my being. Notice that these folks are going way out of their way to make sure that you and I know that they not only believe that God exists, but that they are absolutely, positively, beyond any shadow of a doubt, certain that God exists. And they know His name. They know where He lives. They've got His pager number. All these things they claim to know beyond any shadow of a doubt. Take Billy Graham and Pat Robertson. How do these guys portray the existence of God, life after death, the truth of the Bible, and other religious claims? Do they present these things as mere theories, or do they portray them as absolute certainties? Clearly, they portray certainty. They don't say that God is an interesting theory. They say that God is a fact, that God is real. They even go so far as to say that the reality of God's existence is just plain obvious, and that those people who dare question God's existence are simply lying to themselves. That's what they claim anyway. But do you really think they believe these claims? Let me return to a point that I made earlier. Science does not claim to give us certainty. Be that as it may, some scientific theories have survived the rigors of experimental verification so many zillions of times that our confidence in them is all but certain, and this confidence is reflected in our actions. Now, can the same be said for religion? Remember, many believers boastfully insist that God is real, that God is a fact, even an obvious fact. And they will go almost out of their way to let you know how certain they are of their convictions. Okay, fine. But if this really is the case, if these people really are as certain as they like for us to think they are, then wouldn't it just stand to reason that this certainty would endow them with a confidence in their religion that is even greater than their confidence in science? And if this is the case, then wouldn't we expect to see this greater confidence reflected in their actions? I would think so. But is that what we see? What kind of confidence do people have in the religious claim that there's life after death? The vast majority of Americans claim to believe in life after death, and many of these people claim to be certain of it. That's what they say. But how do they act? Well, have you ever been to a funeral? Do the people at the funeral look like they know for certain that the deceased is alive and well and living the good life in heaven? Or are they all dressed in black and crying? How about the existence of God? What kind of confidence do people place in the religious claim that God exists? Keeping in mind that many people claim to know with every fiber of their beings that God exists. Most Christians today will tell you that they believe in God's ability to heal the sick as taught in the New Testament. That's what they say. But how do they act? Well, what do they do when their kids get sick? Don't they typically take their kids to a doctor? You bet they do. Now, what does that tell us? Do these actions reflect a certainty in God's existence and a certainty in God's ability to heal the sick? Or do they reflect a confidence in medical science? Of course, many believers will object to this line of arguing. They'll respond with something like, "Look, we pray and we take our kids to the doctor. We do both." Okay, fine. But just for kicks, let's go to the New Testament and see what Jesus said about the healing of the sick. In Mark chapter 16, verses 17 and 18, Jesus tells us the following, quote, "These signs will accompany those who believe. In my name they will drive out demons. They will speak in new tongues. They will pick up snakes with their hands. And when they drink deadly poison, it will not hurt them at all. They will place their hands on sick people, and they will get well." Unquote. I don't know about you, but that seems pretty straightforward to me. Let me repeat that last part one more time. Quote, "They will place their hands on sick people, and they will get well." Unquote. Now, there's a claim in these words. The claim is that God is real, and that when believers place their hands on sick people, God will heal them. Now, do people really believe this? Do people who claim to know that God exists really believe this? Do they act like it? Proverbs 3 verse 5 tells us, quote, "Trust in the Lord with all your heart, and lean not on your own understanding." Unquote. Now, do you think that a person who knows with every fiber of his being that God is real is trusting in the Lord when he takes his sick child to a doctor? The scripture says, "Lean not on your own understanding." It seems to me that when a believer calls a doctor, that he's leaning on his own understanding. Or at least he's leaning on his doctor's understanding. He's certainly not relying on the Lord. I mean, after all, what did the Lord say? The Lord said, quote, "They will place their hands on sick people, and they will get well." Unquote. I don't know about you, but it looks to me like the only people who would need doctors are atheists. Let me take this one step further. You're probably aware that there are people in this country who refuse to take their sick children to doctors. Sometimes these children die, needlessly. Sometimes these children die painful deaths, needlessly. This is a terrible and pointless tragedy. Now, why do these parents do this to their own children? Is it because they belong to some whacked-out little cult? I wish I could say that was the case. But it's not. Rather, these parents do these things because they are trying to live a life consistent with the words of Jesus. And what did Jesus say? Jesus said, "They will place their hands on sick people, and they will get well." Now, how does the vast majority of the God-fearing public react to stories about parents who refuse to take their sick children to doctors? The reaction is typically one of outrage, isn't it? I mean, they think these parents are nuts. They think these parents are unfit to raise children. They think these parents belong in jail. Isn't that strange? Polls taken by Gallup and other organizations routinely indicate that somewhere in the neighborhood of 90% of Americans believe in God. 90%. Now, if these statistics are correct, then how do we account for the public outrage directed at parents who, because they take seriously the words of Jesus Christ, refuse to take their sick children to doctors? In a country where 90% of the population allegedly believes in God, you'd think these parents would be hailed as national heroes. Now, I know I've spent a lot of time on this, but I wanted to make the case that just because people claim to believe in something doesn't mean they actually believe it. Talk is cheap. Actions are largely based on confidence. Confidence is largely a function of evidence. And evidence is entirely a function of reality. Think back to that funeral we talked about earlier, the one where everybody's dressed in black and crying. Let's pretend that you're in attendance at this funeral, and all of a sudden your cell phone starts ringing. Profoundly embarrassed, you answer it. You don't recognize the voice on the other end, but it's a man, and he says that he must speak to the widow at once. And so you squeeze your way through the crowd, tap the grieving widow on the shoulder, and tell her, "I'm awfully sorry, ma'am, but it's for you. Some guy says he's got to talk to you right now." Well, the next thing you know, the widow's screaming for joy, jumping up and down, high-fiving the pallbearers. And why? Well, because the man on the phone is her dead husband, and he's calling her from heaven to let her know that he's doing just fine, never better, in fact, and that he looks forward to the day when they'll be reunited. Now, what's just happened to this widow's confidence in the religious claim that there's life after death? Went way up, didn't it? A little phone call, a little evidence, a little piece of reality goes a long, long way. Problem is, people don't make phone calls from the dead. I think people who claim to believe in the Bible have very little confidence in this belief. You can see it in their actions. They're desperate for evidence, any kind of evidence. Have you ever noticed that every time somebody thinks he sees the face of Jesus in a bowl of oatmeal, or the Virgin Mother in a dog turd, the people fly in from all over the world to get a look? I mean, if that's not desperate, then I don't know what is. Again, what are their actions telling us? Yes, we've seen their ads. We've read their promotional literature. We've heard their testimonials. But what do their actions tell us? Most Americans will tell you they believe in the Bible. Do they? Do they believe in the existence of hell? Do they believe in the Great Flood? Do they believe in the cosmic threats of Deuteronomy 28? I mean, do they really, really believe these things? The Bible says that Sabbath breakers must be stoned to death. When was the last time you saw a Sabbath breaker stoned to death? Again, what are their actions telling us? Here's what I think. I think these people are playing games. I think at some point in the believer's past, he stepped over that line that separates fantasy from reality. He stood on that empty lot, and with eyes wide open, he said to himself, "I see a post office here." Somewhere along the way, either through conscious choice, social pressures, or childhood conditioning, he abandoned his sense of reality and adopted instead beliefs that deep down he knows he has little confidence in. I know what it feels like to live on the wrong side of that line. For years, I'd represented to myself and to others that I knew, beyond any doubt, with every fiber of my being, that God was real, that Jesus Christ was His Son, and that the Mormon Church was the true church. In fact, as a missionary for the church, I spent 2 years doing nothing but sharing that testimony with others. But even though I was telling the world that I knew these things to be true, deep down, I had doubts. That was the reality of my situation. I didn't know with every fiber of my being. I was just pretending to know. But I wasn't willing to face up to that. And in so doing, I had planted myself firmly on the wrong side of that line. I wasn't being honest with myself. And that's really what crossing that line is all about. Of course, the doubts never left me. In fact, they just continued to pile up. And eventually it got to the point that I just couldn't take it anymore. So I decided it was time to come clean. I decided it was time to move back to the other side of that line. So that's what I did. Being honest with myself meant that I was no longer going to pretend that I knew my religious beliefs were true. I wasn't saying that they were not true. All I was saying was that I didn't know for sure. And that was the truth. That's all I did. I simply brought my claims in line with the reality of the situation. And let me tell you something. With that simple, honest admission, my life changed. Let me see if I can describe what this change felt like. Have you ever lived next door to some guy who's got one of those car alarms that's always going off in the middle of the night? You know the kind I'm talking about. The kind that goes off every time some bird takes a crap on the hood. Anyway, imagine this guy's alarm's been blaring nonstop for the last 10 years. And then, one day it just stops. And all of a sudden, it's quiet. You almost forgot what quiet was. It'd been so long. But it's quiet again. And because it is quiet, you notice things. Birds chirping, dogs barking, the breeze blowing through the trees, nature. Things that have always been there, but that you never noticed before because you were too distracted by that stupid car alarm. You know, for the greater part of my life, I lived with a noise going off in my head. That noise was the sound of my religious beliefs clashing with reality. Deep down, I always knew this noise was there, but I'd lived with it for so long that I'd come to believe that this was just the way things were supposed to be. I'd mentioned this noise at times to various church leaders and other so-called religious experts, but they assured me that having this noise in my head was all just part of the experience of faith. Little did I know that I could have silenced this noise at any time by simply being honest with myself. As I look back on it, when it came to religion, I didn't even know what being honest felt like. But I do today. On the last tape, I said I would challenge you to do something that could change your life. This is a challenge. Be honest with yourself. Just be brutally honest with yourself when it comes to these religious issues. Step back over that line if you haven't already. You'll be glad you did. If you continue to embrace ideas that you know clash with reality, you risk missing out on all the truly amazing things that reality has to offer. And what a waste that would be. It would be like taking a trip to the Grand Canyon, but never stepping foot out of your hotel room. Being honest with yourself when it comes to religious issues does a couple of things. First, you shut off that damn alarm. You stop that noise, and in its place, you experience a peaceful resonance with reality. Let me tell you something. That part alone is worth the price of admission. But that's just the beginning. Because now you've opened yourself up to the experience of reality. Now you get to go explore the Grand Canyon. And trust me, this is a show you don't want to miss. There was a time when religion was looked to for answers in pretty much every area of human experience. With the birth of modern science just a few short centuries ago, we began to realize that many of our religious conceptions of the physical universe were just plain wrong. Because these conceptions were wrong, we had to be willing to abandon them if we were going to allow true understanding to take root and grow. Notice that it was our willingness to let go of bad ideas that made it possible for good ideas to even be considered as candidates for truth. That's how our understanding has evolved in the area of the physical sciences. But let me ask you something here. Do you think this approach would also work with those fundamental areas we talked about earlier? The areas of morality, meaning in life, and purpose in life? When it comes to these areas, most people believe that true understanding is to be found in the wisdom of the ancients, as recorded in books like the Bible. But could it be that just as we have experienced in the physical sciences, that religion has been wrong in these areas too? And could it be that there's something better out there that we're missing out on, simply because we've committed ourselves to some ancient creed? I think there is something better. A lot better. A whole lot better. But as we found with the physical sciences, we must first be willing to let go of the bad before we can let in the good. On the next two tapes, we will examine the subjects of morality, meaning in life, and purpose in life, areas that have long been considered the exclusive domain of religion. On tapes 4 and 5, we'll take a hard look at what the Bible teaches about these subjects, and then we'll compare what the Bible teaches with some reality-based alternatives that I personally think work a whole lot better. Until then, thank you for listening, and please take care.